Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Patent law can be, to be kind, dense. Terms like prior art and intellectual property get bandied about like they belong in everyday conversation. A federal judge dispensed with all that today. Verizon is suing the internet phone company Vonage for patent infringement. And the judge said not only did Vonage infringe, it can't sign up any new customers while it appeals. But then, an appellate court said, can you hear me now? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Science and technology reports are supported by Boston Scientific, committed to delivering what's next in medical technology to help clinicians improve and extend lives. BostonScientific.com. Marketplace is also supported by T. Rowe Price, managing investments for the long term with a consistent, disciplined approach. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence. 1-877 T. Rowe Price.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, April 6th today. TGIF, everybody. Great to have you here. Verizon will surely be in the history books when they write about telecommunications in the early 21st century. It put something called VoIP on the map and in the public consciousness, voice over internet protocol, using the internet to make phone calls for practically nothing. Today, U.S. District Judge Claude Hilton might have truncated the company's eventual entry into those history books. No new customers while Vonage appeals his ruling that it stole some ideas from wireless giant Verizon. But then the Circuit Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C. decided to weigh in. Marketplace's Bob Moon is here with more on that story. Bob, what exactly did the court rule today?
Well, Kai, late today, Vonage said that it managed to secure a temporary stay of the judge's order until the appeals court can hear its request for a permanent stay. Now, this amounts to Vonage begging for a little breathing room here, to borrow a metaphor that Vonage's own attorney used in court today. He said not allowing Vonage to sign up new customers would amount to cutting off its oxygen rather than a bullet to the head. And it's absolutely critical to Vonage to be able to sign up these new customers. It's already got a churn rate of 2.5% a month. That's the rate that existing customers have been canceling, and Vonage has to sign up new ones to replace them, so winning this day was really crucial.
Might want to point out that Vonage shares are down something like 80% since this whole trial started bubbling up to the top. Where does the company go now?
They have been in really big trouble. They're still gasping for air, if you will. Under intense competition from big-name broadband competitors, the cable and the DSL providers that have been moving in with cheap package deals, at least this gives Vonage the chance to stay in the game a little bit. And also, the company is trying to do an end run around this whole patent infringement case here. They've been trying to figure out how to connect calls without using the technologies that Verizon claims it developed.
You do feel a little bad. It's mighty Verizon versus is what not too long ago was a startup, Vonage.
That's correct. And Vonage, in this case, really has very little breathing room because they have very little capital left here. They have, according to some analysts, maybe a year of capital that they continue to spend to get those new customers. And it's been very difficult for them to sign them up.
All right. Vonage, Verizon, and Bob Moon. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Kai.
VoIP was the lead story today. The off-lead brings us another acronym, IPCC. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change issued its second of what are planned to be four reports on global warming today. That story's right up Sam Eaton's alley. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Kai.
We had this report that came out in February talking about how global warming is happening, that human beings are 90% probably the cause of it. What does this report have to say?
Basically, Kai, though, a lot of people are calling this the emotional heart of climate change research. This is the first time scientists, and we're talking about thousands of scientists from dozens of countries, came out with a report that described in detail what's already happening due to global warming and what's likely to happen. Basically, how species, water supplies, ice sheets, regional weather patterns are faring. And the bottom line is not so well. And the point the report makes is that there are real economic and social consequences to these changes, already measurable ones, and they're likely to get worse.
Well, let's pursue that for just a second. Who might stand to gain and who might stand to lose?
Yeah, Kai, this is perhaps maybe the cruel irony of climate change and global warming. Some of the northern latitudes, these industrialized nations that have been basically spewing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere for more than a century, could actually see some benefits of global warming, according to this report, at least in the short term. You have more rain, longer growing seasons, the opening of, say, the Arctic shipping route, which we've reported on this program. But say, you know, temperatures rise 3 to 5 degrees Fahrenheit, you balance that out with a mass extinction of about a quarter of the world's species, flooded coastlines, and the poorest of the poor, say African island nations, would be the worst hit, creating perhaps, you know, hundreds of millions of environmental refugees.
All right, so follow me on this one for a minute. There are some who have called this maybe the market failure of all time. Those who are least responsible for global warming are paying the highest price. Does this report talk about any remedies, any possible solutions that richer countries can offer?
Number one, I think, Kai, would be money. More money is needed into adaptation projects going into the poorest of the countries. These are the people that are going to be the most hardest hit and the least able to deal with that within their own economies. Currently, the funding in that area is in the tens of millions of dollars, so really kind of minuscule. Another option would be, you know, bringing the developing world into more into the cap and trade program, a global system where they could benefit from, say, forestry projects, that kind of thing, sell those credits on a world market.
Cap and trade, where Western industrialized countries are figuring out how to basically buy and sell the right to pollute.
Sure, and developing nations could play a very positive role in that.
Sam, what recommendations or suggestions does the report offer as a way to avoid what everybody says are catastrophic consequences?
The bottom line, Kai, is a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. This is the least costly way to deal with this issue long term. There's a gradient of cost to, you know, projected temperature rises. The worst case scenario, we're talking 5% of global GDP. That's trillions of dollars, not to mention a 13 to 20 foot sea level rise. So the costs can be, of business as usual, are very significant.
Sam Eaton covers global warming and a whole lot of other things from our sustainability desk. Thank you, Sam.
Thanks, Kai.
We are left to wonder how Wall Street would have reacted to that report today. Equities markets were closed. CNBC was running game show repeats all day, but there was some trading going on. We'll have the details and a look at the four-day week on Wall Street when we do the numbers. It's a slow day in Washington. Congress is out of town, and it's Good Friday to boot. Our Steve Henn found himself with some extra time on his hands this morning, and he spent it online with a database he found from the Office of Management and Budget and its list of more than 13,000 congressional earmarks from the 2005 budget cycle, $19 billion worth of pork in all. Here's Steve with just some of what he learned today.
Good government types say a database of congressional earmarks is an important first step. And it makes for some pretty interesting reading. The largest single set-aside in 2005 went to Boeing, $168 million for four fat Chinook helicopters. The second largest earmark went to, wait for it, Boeing, this one for fighter planes. But earmarks are hard to track, even for government insiders.
Oftentimes, you're talking about, you know, maybe one line in a report or in legislation that's hundreds of pages long.
So Dana Chasen at OMB Watch wasn't surprised that more than 2 years after this money was appropriated and presumably spent, the White House can't tell us who ultimately received more than 600 earmarks worth about $800 million.
Isn't it amazing?
Danielle O'Brien from the Project on Government Oversight has tracked similar problems at the Pentagon for years.
You know, it's a lot of the time we don't know where our money's being spent. It's horrifying.
The Department of Defense told the OMB the ultimate recipients of 51 separate congressional earmarks worth $367 million were, quote, unknown. OMB officials say they believe many of these issues are just technical misunderstandings, and they hope to get more answers soon. One answer we may never get, even with this database, is which members of Congress put these projects in the budget to begin with. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn. for Marketplace.
The timing really couldn't have been better for Steve's discovery this morning. The Senate's back at work next week with the 2008 budget still to be finalized. One of the issues at the heart of the health care debate has been who's paying. Critics of the status quo say consumers are less cautious than they ought to be when they're spending insurance company money. So one of the hot new trends is something called consumer-directed plans, also known as high-deductible options, where patients or their parents pay a lot out of pocket before insurance kicks in. Employers like them because the premiums are lower, and the Bush administration has been pushing them as a way to cut costs. But a new study points out that these plans penalize part of the population, 51% of it, in fact. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WGBH, Helen Palmer has the story.
You can blame biology.
We women have breasts, we have uteruses, we're the ones who have the babies.
Harvard's Steffi Woolhandler is an author of the Journal of General Internal Medicine study. She says those biological facts add up to big differences in the health costs men and women face.
For people under the age of 45, men would average just under $500, whereas women average closer to $1,500 a year.
So she says if your boss decides to shift to a high-deductible plan, it's like giving female employees a $1,000 pay cut, because the first $2,000 or so of health costs come directly out of your pocket. But Melinda Bucus-Buntin of the RAND Corporation takes issue with Woolhandler's figures. They come from medical expenditure data for 2003, not the costs people are actually paying under these plans. Buntin says large employers are designing them carefully.
92% of those large employers are offering preventive care coverage before these higher deductibles are met.
The health insurers trade group says the same. Over 90% of the plans cover preventive services without making the consumer pay up front. And Mike Tuffin of America's Health Insurance Plan says women like high deductible plans just as much as men.
People buying these plans are split almost perfectly evenly between men and women. It's 51% men and 49% women.
Woolhandler isn't impressed, though. She says even if, say, a preventive screening's covered, any follow-up wouldn't be. That means higher bills for women and the sick. But, of course, it's those higher bills that advocates say will help consumer-directed plans control health costs. If we have to pay more, we'll go to the doctor less. In Boston, I'm Helen Palmer for Marketplace.
Tennessee Attorney General Bob Cooper is dipping a toe in the art market. He's not buying anything. Instead, Cooper's put the brakes on a deal between Fisk University in Nashville and the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Fisk is a historically black college that finds itself in a financial rough patch, rich in assets but low on cash. One of those assets is an art collection donated by Georgia O'Keeffe herself. The school had worked out a deal to sell the centerpiece of the collection to the O'Keeffe Museum. But Cooper, the attorney general, said it's time to let the free market work. Blake Farmer reports.
The financial future of Fisk University may hang on a canvas. Fisk needs money to replenish its already modest endowment, which has been cut in half over the past decade due to poor management and rising costs. The school had struck a deal with Georgia O'Keeffe's estate that her iconic work, Radiator Building, Night New York, could be sold on the cheap for $7 million to the O'Keeffe Museum in Santa Fe. That would keep the painting in the family. But Tennessee Attorney General Bob Cooper suspended the sale in February and now has called it off entirely. As the steward of charitable gifts, he says O'Keeffe made clear before her death that she wanted the Stieglitz collection to stay together. Cooper also thought the school was selling the work short.
Now it seems clear, based on the offers that Fisk has received, that in fact $7 million is an inadequate price. I think I did call it a bargain basement price.
Since the deal was suspended, offers have climbed as high as $25 million. Fisk President Hazel O'Leary says it was hard to know what the O'Keeffe would command, considering 20th century art is fetching record prices. One way or the other, O'Leary says the school is in desperate need of funds for scholarships and research.
We'll mortgage, sell whatever we have to.
While the university waits for the okay to sell the paintings, O'Leary says the school will ask alumni for extra support and look for grant money.
That's what we'll be doing for the near term, and we will be as creative as we possibly can with respect to what else we borrow from.
Fisk has filed suit to sell the painting and now looks to be headed to court this summer. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
Right about this time on a Friday, I say we're going down to Dallas to check the week on Wall Street. We're going somewhere to talk to David Johnson. I don't really even know where you are this week.
Suwanee, Tennessee, one of the most beautiful places in the lower 48.
Why are you there?
Well, because I learned a long time ago that why take a three-day weekend when you can turn it into a four, or in this case, actually a five-day weekend.
So you haven't been working now since what, Tuesday afternoon?
No, well, I've been keeping up, and this is the wonderful thing. When I went to school here at the University of the South, we were remote. They would throw a Chattanooga Times occasionally somewhere near the dorm, but you couldn't even get radio reception. Now I can sit here and I can call up my, you know, my brokerage computer. I can use Slingbox to watch Bloomberg or CNBC and get the wire services.
Better yet, you can actually be on the radio from Suwanee, Tennessee.
How oh, yeah, that? Then there's that. And a good day to do it, too, because the Labor Department didn't entirely take the day off.
Well, that's right. New jobs, 180,000 of them. Were you at all uptight leaving your province down in Dallas and the working world to the people who were going to figure out this number and then tell it with nobody working today?
No, I really wasn't. It looked like, it still looks like after we had them, and it looked like we were going to continue to have this sort of Goldilocks scenario. I looked at the numbers that came out this week and watched the, you know, my favorite leading indicator, the transportation mm-hmm. average doing well. You figure if people are flying and goods are being shipped, that something's got to be all right. They're overcoming the high fuel prices. I think by early in the week, the Iranian-UK situation looked like it was probably going to be handled. And then you look back, and the market's been up, the Dow's anyway, been up, I think, 6 days in a row.
No, I know. I think it was up 2.5% for the week. I mean, it's quite a run.
Yeah, it is. And especially if you consider that, and truthfully, I'm resting up for what's going to be a busy season over the next few weeks, because we're just getting into earnings season.
Yeah.
Tuesday, Alcoa, which is always the first of the Dow stocks, alphabetically and otherwise, to report their numbers, will come with the numbers. And the bar is set very, very low. I think the expectation is that after either 13 or 14 quarters of double-digit gains, we're going to see overall earnings up about 3.3%. So what you saw this week, I mean, it makes it all the more remarkable. What you saw this week was with full knowledge that we're going to go into a real slowdown in earnings, which makes it all the more remarkable, or traders all that much more stupid.
All right, well, hold on a second. What about this whole business spending as a driver of the economy? And if they're not making money, they're not spending money, so where does that leave us?
Well, so it slows up. But again, if you're going to wake up in the middle of the night, you know, in a cold sweat, worried about inflation, this is going to help you sleep at night. And the feeling is that this is a slowdown. The expectation is the earnings go back to double-digit gains by the end of the quarter. And in the perfect world, the stock market's supposed to be looking 6 months ahead. I mean, we're not supposed to be looking at April right now. We're supposed to be looking at October.
Yeah, because that's what we look to Wall Street for, strategic thinking, right?
Well, not this week.
Not this week. David Johnson in Suwanee, Tennessee. David, we'll talk to you, I guess, next week.
Great to talk to you, Kai. Have a good weekend.
Coming up, uncomfortable truths about culture and work.
Low-skilled black males, that is, individuals with less than a high school education, spend only around 50% of their time working.
But first, let's do the numbers. Stock exchanges in most of the world were closed today for Good Friday, but just a recap for this holiday-shortened trading week, the Dow Industrials rose 1.6%. The Nasdaq gained 2%, the S&P 500 up for the week by 1.6%. That put stocks just a hair shy of where they were before that big tumble back at the end of February. Numbers were moving on the bond market, though. Bond prices fell during the two-hour trading window today. I guess they weren't working so hard. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 4.75%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Since 1937, supporting the role that an experienced financial advisor can play in building a well-rounded financial program. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation. Heard a report on Marketplace that you just have to share with your friends, family, or coworkers? Help is just a click away. Our website has each day's complete newscast, individual stories, and transcripts, so you can listen again, print them out, or email them to everyone you know. It's all at marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Monday. The first billionaire in space arrives at the International Space Station. Charles Simonyi blasts off from Russia this weekend. President Bush is in Yuma, Arizona. He'll speak on immigration before returning to the White House for the annual Easter egg roll. And if you hunt down more Easter eggs than you can digest over the weekend, next week is Egg Salad Week. 7 days to make delicious use of all those colorful treasures. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. If you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all. A nice rule to live by when you can. But the reality of office life is that sometimes you just have to say something. Nothing wrong with lying, says commentator Lucy Calloway.
I am a liar. This statement doesn't sound pretty, but it's the truth. So far today, I've congratulated someone on their new job, even though I think it a complete mystery how they ever got promoted. I emailed various readers thanking them for their interesting points, which I actually thought were tedious. If you work in an organization, I bet my shirt that you're a liar too. We're all liars, but lies are necessary. The corporate world demands them. Indeed, it can't function without them. There are loads of reasons for this. Workplaces are hierarchies. That means we kiss up and kick down. Offices are competitive, which means you have to put your best foot forward and sell yourself, which usually means stretching the truth. The rules of office life also invite us all to cover up infringements, so we lie about taking days off, being late for work, or slacking. Unrealistic targets and budgets also make lying essential. In fact, lying about the work itself is necessary to keep us doing it. Thus, we claim to be passionate about what we do, when in fact we barely tolerate it. Lies are so deeply woven into the fabric of office life that if you took them away, the whole thing would unravel. I know an ad man who's an alcoholic. Recently, he joined Alcoholics Anonymous and took a promise always to be truthful. When he returned to work, he took it upon himself to tell a client they were being overcharged. He instantly became far more dangerous as a truth-teller than he had ever been as a drunk. It's a dangerous balance. The lies that we tell have to be believable, but somehow we must stop somewhere short of actually believing them ourselves. The most dangerous people in business are the ones who believe their own lies.
Lucy Calloway is a management columnist for the Financial Times. Tell us lies if you like, just tell us something. Send your comments to us through our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. We mentioned the unemployment report earlier. 180,000 new jobs added to the economy last month. The unemployment rate fell. That's a measure of the number of people looking for work. It's down to a five-month low of 4.4%. But go deeper into that data, to the lines breaking out black men, 20 and older, and the numbers look far less positive. 9% unemployment, that's up 0.5% from a year ago. And Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports some consider that figure an underestimate.
The unemployment numbers don't count people who have stopped looking for work or can't because they're in jail. For his research at the University of California, San Diego, Gordon Hansen prefers to measure the number of weeks a person works in a year. By that calculation, the figures for some African Americans are disheartening.
Low-skilled black males, that is, individuals with less than a high school education, spend only around 50% of their time working.
By other estimates, 72% of young black men who have dropped out of school are jobless. What's going on here? In part, Hansen says, immigration has created more competition for jobs and depressed wages. But technology has had an even bigger impact.
This is an automated facility with no cashiers at the exit.
Many of the remaining factory jobs have migrated overseas. Of course, racial discrimination in the workplace remains an issue. Taken together, all this has left many young black men alienated from the culture of work. Columbia University professor Ron Mincy.
Our failure to integrate these young men throughout school and into the workplace has intergenerational consequences. The challenges that we are experiencing now are going to be recycling over generations to come.
Some in the black community say it's a catastrophe and one that's being ignored. Rob Carmona is president and CEO of Strive, a program based in Harlem that teaches job skills.
The culture of work is a learned trait.
In the classroom, Carmona doesn't pull punches.
All you guys that were in jail, do you have brothers or sisters that didn't go to jail?
Yes.
What
yes.
did they do?
One drive a bus and one do security.
Driving the bus for the city?
Yes.
Civil servant, makes a good buck, probably got a nice crib, got money in his clothes, right?
By contrast, Carmona's clients are often removed from the working world and its office etiquette.
They come from communities where their whole world is a 5 or 6 block radius. And they have no inkling as to what's appropriate below 96th Street.
Midtown Manhattan is just a few subway stops from Harlem.
42nd Street, Grand Central will be next. Thank you, the doors, please.
Here at Grand Central Station, Columbia University professor Mincy recently stumbled upon a job interview in progress. He sensed, correctly, that the three young black men would not get hired.
They were not dressed appropriately for an employment interview. They wore hats the whole time, half of them on backwards. They just did not comport themselves in such a way that I would have hired them myself.
On the inner city streets, young guys learn to put on a game face, an expression that communicates, "Don't mess with me." Mincy says they don't realize that it works against them in a work environment.
They haven't a clue as to what these appropriate skills are, but there's no place in their set of movements where they're likely to acquire those skills.
Uptown at a street market in Harlem, I asked young black men who hadn't finished high school about their employment prospects.
For a person to get a job that doesn't have a high school diploma or a GED, you're going to get like a job paying about $6, $8 an hour. You know, I put it in this term, low-class jobs, you know.
I didn't really want no Burger King or McDonald's job. I wanted something better for myself.
At Strive, the job training program, Rob Carmona works to counter the stigma against entry-level positions.
Very little of the concept of crawling before you walk is imparted in the American psyche.
As for Columbia professor Ron Mincy, he advocates more job shadowing programs. But despite the urgent need, he says there's been a long-term decline in workforce development funding at the federal level, and many of those paying the price are young, unskilled black men. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals at Vanguard.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, there was a development today in the ongoing probe into the student loan business. The U.S. Department of Education announced an official there has been placed on leave. Mateo Fontana ran a federal financial aid program while owning about $100,000 worth of shares in a student loan company. New York State Attorney General Andrew Cuomo kicked off the investigation. Student loan lenders are said to have given kickbacks to financial aid officers at several schools. The University of Texas, Columbia University, and the University of Southern California have already put several of their financial aid employees on leave due to that investigation. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. U.S. markets were closed today for Good Friday, as were most of the overseas markets. Tokyo was open and down, just for the record. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Now, if you're lucky, you won't have to hear this sound until Monday morning.
It's R2-D2.
Join us next time for the alarm clock that really gets around. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.